Thank you. Thank you for all coming tonight. My name is Richard McGregor. I'm a senior fellow for East Asia at the Lowy Institute. Before we start, I'd just like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to the elders past and present. Here today we have three distinguished experts on one of the major regional issues facing us, maybe the contest of the century, as one person called it, the South China Sea. Dr. Wu Shetsun of the National Institute of South China Sea Studies in Hainan is one of China's most prominent experts and international speakers on this issue. Dr. Linda Jakobsen, a long-standing resident of China, a long-standing scholar, previously at the Lowy Institute, and now the CEO and founder of the consultancy China Matters. And Dr. Benjamin Schreyer of Macquarie University and a distinguished international relations academic. All doctors, actually, except for me. I barely finished university. So the South China Sea, I think, has been well described as a massive connective economic tissue where global sea routes coalesce, or as one person put it, the throat of the Western Pacific, connecting the Western Pacific and Indian Oceans. Just to give you one figure, the oil transported through the Malacca Straits from the Indian Ocean en route to East Asia and the South through the South China Sea is triple the amount that passes through the Suez Canal and 15 times the amount that goes through the Panama Canal. So not only is it fundamental to global trade, it's also a cauldron of multiple territorial disputes between China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, even Brunei to some extent, and depending on how you define it, Indonesia as well. On top of that, the most powerful country for the moment and the most powerful navy in the area is a nation with no territorial claims, and that's, of course, the United States. Finally, the South China Sea is, of course, both pivotal to Australia's strategic outlook and trade. So we're going to start. I'm going to give each panelist about 6 to 7 minutes. I'll start with a question for each of them. Then we'll have a discussion amongst ourselves, and then we can have questions for the final 15 or 20 minutes. I'm going to try and be quite disciplined with all our panelists to keep them to their allotted time. Let's start with Dr. Wu. Now, China in recent years has built some large islands in the South China Sea, far bigger than other claimants, which also built islands. These islands house substantial military assets or have the ability to do so. On top of that, of course, China is building a substantial navy, as you'd expect from a country of China's size and interests. Now, the Pacific used to be called an American lake, and that was not always a flattering way of putting it. Is the South China Sea slowly but surely becoming a Chinese lake?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to visit the Lowy Institute and have opportunities to discuss relevant issues we concerned. Due to time limitations, just 6 minutes, I'm going to look at the South China Sea, as Richard just mentioned. I try to answer your question and respond to your remarks. Generally speaking, the current situation of South China Sea has been peaceful and stable since the second half of 2016, when China-Philippines relations was improved and the China-ASEAN reached a consensus on the COC consultation.
COC being
the code of conduct in the South China Sea. So with regard to the current status of South China Sea situation and the future development, I would mention 4 points. Point one, China-US military confrontation in recent years heated up in the South China Sea situation, and it will be the dominant factor of the future development. There is a growing deficit of China-US military mutual trust and a strategic suspicion between China and the United States increased. The U.S. policy on China is dominated by the hawks. Compared with the other issues such as North Korea's nuclear program, Taiwan issue, and the trade issue, the United States is at a passive position with few options on the issue of the South China Sea. Foreseeably, China-U.S. military competition in the South China Sea will intensify because the United States will primarily take the following measures. They are increase the frequency and the scope of freedom navigation operations of NOPS, invite its allies to participate in the FNOPS, further disrupt China-Philippines, China-Vietnam relations, encourage other claimants to take unilateral actions, and play up the militarization of the South China Sea. Resort to Taiwan on the issue of South China Sea. For example, United States may using Taiping Island, from my own perspective, as a military base, increase military cooperation with other countries near the South China Sea.
I'm just going to say, Taiping is claimed by Taiwan, right?
Taiping, Ito Aba.
Yeah.
Ito Aba. So, United States may, you know, reaffirm the validity of the arbitral tribunal's award of the South China Sea arbitration case initiated by the Philippines in 2013. So, look into the future. The FNOPS, closing reconnaissance, intelligence gathering, military exercises, port visits, and other forms of military activities in the surrounding regions will become key forms of U.S. military presence in this region. Strategic blocks by United States and Japan towards the Western Pacific region, and by United States, Japan, India, and Australia towards the Indian Ocean against China will remain key geopolitical challenges to China towards the directions of both the Pacific and the Indian Oceans. Point two, Japan and Australia, Australia will become a new uncertainties that influence the development of the South China Sea situation. Japan's intention to intervene in the affairs of South China Sea as an important way to seek its military power status, promote a revision of the pacifist constitution, impede China's development, and disrupt China-ASEAN relations, you know, can be evidenced in various facts, such as its maritime, you know, self-defense forces entry into the South China Sea. If we look at it last year, the Japan sent its maritime self-defense forces destroyer into the South China Sea from last May to August this year, this coming this September, Japan self-defense forces, you know, a helicopter carrier will be in the South China Sea region again. So bilateral cooperation with, you know, some other South China Sea claimants with strong military elements and its advocacy of its publication of joint declarations on the South China Sea issue on various, you know, occasions. It's the ways of Japan to interfere the South China Sea affairs. Australia's intervention in the South China Sea affairs are mainly manifested in its high-profile diplomatic and political statements. For instance, if we look at last year's, you know, Australia's, you know, behavior with regard to South China Sea issue. Your Prime Minister, you know, Turnbull demanded China to comply with law-based international order in his speech in last year's, you know, Shangri-La dialogue. And also during ASEAN foreign ministers' meetings in 2016, 2017, and this year, Australia, the United States, and Japan released the joint declarations of foreign ministers, which claimed the arbitral tribunal's award on the Philippines on the South China Sea issue as valid, and requested involved countries, particularly China, to implement the arbitral tribunal's award and opposed the militarization of the islands and reefs in the South China Sea. Meanwhile, the Indo-Pacific strategy initiated by the United States against China is not only supported by Japan, but also enthusiastically welcomed by Australia. Point three.
One more minute.
Yeah. Okay, just a couple of sentences. The point three, Vietnam is another country in this region that creates destructive uncertainty in the South China Sea and is also a proxy of the US and Japan in intervening in the South China Sea affairs. Point four, the validity of the Philippine policy on the South China Sea and the unilateral actions of some countries in disputed areas, you know, have negative impact on the development of the South China Sea situation that cannot be underestimated. So I would stop here.
Thank you. Thanks for that. Thank you. Now, Linda, at the start there, Dr. Wu talked about the dominant factor being the U.S., the strategic suspicion between U.S. and China. I mean, what is the U.S. role in the South China Sea? Is it to sort of retire gracefully, stand by its allies? I mean, how is the sort of great power competition, how do you see that playing out?
Thank you, Richard. Before I answer the question, let me thank you for inviting me. Good to be back at the Lowy Institute, where I did indeed work. I have two tiny corrections to make. I join you. I am not a doctor, so I don't have a PhD. And China Matters is actually not a consultancy. We aim to advance good China policy. I used to work a lot on the South China Sea back in the days when I was at the Lowy Institute, but now only as one issue looking at the Australia-China relationship. But to answer your question, in these opening remarks, I'll do so. I basically have two points to make, and that's that both the United States and China, in my view, are at a crossroads when it comes to the South China Sea, and I'll explain why. And the second point I'll make is that Australia does have a role, a different role than it has today, in my view, and could take somewhat of a leadership role even if it wanted to. But I'll begin with China, if I may, and I'll get to the United States very quickly. I think one of the things that needs to be acknowledged is the strategy that China has had has been immensely successful in implementing what it set out to do, and that is to establish a maritime buffer zone. China feels very vulnerable in its maritime sphere, and basically by building these artificial islands, it has met the demand of feeling more secure. A few years ago, no one liked me saying this, though in Canberra, off the record, the security establishment at the senior levels were already saying this. Short of war, no one can stop China from holding those islands and continuing to militarize them. We even heard that now from the United States Indo-Pacific new commander just some time ago. So, effectively, it is a fait accompli what China has done in the South China Sea. Now, going forward, China can continue to solidify its position and continue to move more military assets onto these artificial islands. It could also take advantage of possibly Trump's inattention and do what still 2 years ago we thought China would not do. It could start dredging and building on Scarborough Shoal. It needs a very strong radar presence.
Scarborough Shoal being close to the Philippines.
Only a few hundred miles, actually, from Manila. So it's a strategically very important shoal. It could even be as blatantly assertive as to grab another land feature in a disputed area. Probably it would be the Vietnam land feature, because Vietnam, after all, which we never remember when we talk about China, actually controls most of the land features in the disputed waters. So China could continue at this level and strengthen what it already has, but it could, because of the Trump administration and because of what they probably would see as a window of opportunity, actually ramp up its assertive posture and do more. The United States, in my view, is also, Richard, at a crossroads. It can continue with these FONOPs. As Dr. Wu said, it could even increase the FONOPs, but this is very ineffective. The FONOPs has not led to China changing its view of the need to have a maritime buffer zone, as I call it. United States could conceivably increase marine patrols through Philippines. It could even come out publicly and make a statement that the defense treaty with Philippines includes the same sort of guarantees for U.S. involvement like President Obama did vis-a-vis Japan. None of this is going to be effective I mean, it is not going to lead to China withdrawing from the artificial islands. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out, because surely there are voices in Beijing who would like to see more action now when they think that Trump will not move because of rocks in the sea, so to speak. My second point is that of Australia's. One thing that I didn't mention when I was talking about China just now was it is probable that they will start to cajole, persuade, coerce, bully other claimants to start co-developing the resources in disputed waters with them. That is certainly an option which I think personally myself is the most probable. I don't consider Philippines an unwilling partner. Under Duterte, they have willingly entered into agreements which hopefully, from the Chinese point of view, will be signed when Xi Jinping visits Manila later this year. But there are other claimants who absolutely do not want to co-develop, and I think there'll be a lot of pressure on them from China to engage in co-development contracts which are obviously beneficial for China. And here comes Australia's role. I think Australia could really take the lead with other nations to call out China, put pressure on China to not coerce and bully other claimants to develop if it is against the wishes of that claimant. I don't consider Philippines as unwilling. 1 minute, okay. I only need half. And the second thing that Australia could do, and possibly even in a leadership role, is to start discussing with China, encouraging China, possibly even pressuring China to use these artificial islands for the benefit of the whole region, to use these islands to provide public goods. I'm not talking only about sea and rescue. Many observers have spoken about that. I'm talking about humanitarian assistance and disaster relief much more broadly. And even, and I quote a U.S. former CIA China hand who lives in this country and works for the University of Canberra, John Powers, they could start using these islands to fight piracy in the South China Sea. They could really make these islands beneficial for the whole region. And as this, I think quite ironically, this former CIA intelligence officer working on China said, stop wringing your hands, stop bemoaning the fact that China has these islands. They have them. Nothing short of war is going to stop them, but let's put them to good use. Thanks.
So, Ben, should we stop wringing our hands? Dr. Wu didn't say exactly this today, but many Chinese who come here will say to us, why is Australia saying anything at all? Because we're not a claimant state. So, I mean, put Australia in a bit more of a detailed context here.
Yeah, well, first of all, so thank you for having me. I guess my first point would be that, and I'm not a government official, but when I'm traveling to Canberra talking to people, I think the first thing to note is that the level of distrust in Canberra vis-a-vis China is really extraordinarily high at this point of time. I think there's not a lot of trust left. And the reason is because we have seen China breaking one promise after the other. In recent years, over a number of years, saying, you know, we're not militarizing those islands. Then those islands were militarized. We're not deploying certain military systems to those islands. And those military systems were deployed. From an Australian perspective, you don't have to be a claimant state to be deeply worried about what's happening in the South China Sea. I think the first mistake that we often make is that we just focus on the South China Sea as sort of a single entity, when in fact it's part of a much bigger picture, which is a power, a battle for power, when, if you think in these terms, a grand strategic power battle for the whole of the Asia-Pacific and even parts of the Indian Ocean. So I guess from an Australian point of view, what you see what China is doing in the South China Sea, you see this not just as, you know, building islands. You see this as trying to establish a sub-regional hegemony in Southeast Asia, and then potentially extending further north and even further south in the future. So this is way bigger than just a discussion about the you know, international law and code of the conduct and the law of the sea, where Australia, just like many other countries in the region and even beyond the region, has a very different interpretation of whether international law applies and in what ways than China does. I think another reason why Australia is so concerned about this as well is because, quite frankly, this country has been based on the belief and the guarantee that the United States, as you mentioned in your introductory remark, has been, you know, the benign hegemon in the region. We not always agree with what the United States has been doing, but by and large, we were happy with the United States, you know, dominating the seas and providing prosperity and stability for almost all countries in the region. The North Koreans would probably disagree. We are not so sure whether we would see the same if there was a Chinese hegemony. And I think at the grand strategic level, that is what worries strategic policymakers in Canberra, because put to an Australian audience, you can raise the question, would you be comfortable with a Chinese hegemony in the region that dominated this, not just the South China Sea, but also large parts of Southeast Asia? Is this something that Australians would feel comfortable with? Well, I've been here almost 10 years in this country, and my sense is that the answer is probably not. Now, the other point that I wanted to make is that this is a very long-term game. And I do believe that even though politicians, of course, have to think in electoral cycles, for some analysts, 2 or 3 years is already a long, long time. But I think we really need to think about the South China Sea and what happens there as a really long-term, drawn-out battle, in the sense that it's not just, again, about who's building some outposts there, who is increasing its naval presence, but it's more or less China step by step normalizing what large parts in the Australian establishment and probably also the Australian people would see as problematic behavior. And this is a very long-term struggle, and this is why I completely agree with Linda, even though she might not completely agree with my analysis. This is where Australia has an absolute interest to play a stronger role, an active role, to be part of what is going to become a very long and costly engagement, including through stronger presence of Australia in the region and continued support for all those states that are affected more immediately by what China is doing. Not to say that everything that China does is bad and should be condemned, but on this very issue, I think in Canberra there is not much shall we say gray zone. And I was at that speech that Turnbull gave in Shangri-La too. And I think the thing that stuck in my mind was when he quoted the former founder of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, and said, look, just like Lee Kuan Yew said, we should not come into a situation where we are the shrimp between the whales, because that's certainly not in the interest of Australia. And this is why, you know, come back to your original question, why Australia is so concerned about this.
Dr. Wee, you've got two versions, if you like, or two different views on that Australia should play a bigger role. We've had many Chinese visitors here who say Australia should take much less of a role, let alone comment on it. What's your response to that?
May I respond to the question that Linda raised, both Linda and Ben? I should point out that it is not true that China has established a radar in Scarborough Shoal. Not yet.
No. Yeah, I said that they might want to do so. They have not done so.
Has no intention to do so.
Okay, that's interesting.
Given the fact that China you know, the Philippines relationship was improved, mm-hmm. and in the future, you know, wants to improve further the bilateral relationship. It is in the interest, you know, to maintain the good relationship between China and the Philippines. So
I would agree.
And the second one is what you just mentioned, Australia should pressure China to not to conduct a with coercive behavior and bully countries in this region. What kind of measure Australia will take, push pressure on China? And also, I agree with you that, you know, China would like to use these recommended islands and reefs to provide public goods to the international community, particularly countries in this region, for instance, search and rescue base, and provide shelters to fishermen, you know, who are fishing in this region, on also you know, marine protection cooperation between China and the regional countries. As you might remember that at the very beginning of China, you know, conducted reclamation of South China Sea Islands, China announced that the Mitch Island would be served as a maritime cooperation island for China and the international community. So it's right, China would like to provide, you know, public goods on those islands and reefs to ban. Could you elaborate more about Australia's South China Sea policy? To my understanding, Australia's South China Sea policy is, you know, looks like U.S. South China policy, that is, you know, taking sides to the South China Sea dispute, rather than as the U.S., you know, stated that the United States, you know, takes no side towards the South China Sea sovereignty.
Well, no position on sovereignty.
On sovereignty. Yeah. But if we look at Australia, you know, support the Philippines arbitration case, and also, you know, endorses U.S. phenoms in the South China Sea towards China. From my point of view, Australia is taking sides towards the South China Sea issue. Even though you promised that Australia takes no sides towards the sovereignty issue.
Ben?
No, I wouldn't say that Australia is taking sides. I think Australia is doing what the United States and many other countries in the region, but also externally in the region, have been doing for quite a while, namely to reassert or assert their rights as they see it, and as Australia sees it, to sail wherever they want to sail and to fly wherever they want to fly, in accordance with international law. So we should maybe keep in mind and remember that when the decision was taken in the arbitration ruling with the Philippines, it was not just Australia and the United States and Japan. It was also, for instance, the European Union that came out in support for this ruling, which, after all, is an international body. So I do not believe that Australia is taking sides. And by the way, Australia has been conducting what you might call freedom of navigation operations for many, many, many years, even before the whole South China Sea issue came up. Australian aircraft have been flying consistently out of Butterworth Air Base in Malaysia, flying wherever they wanted, in terms of being, you know, in regards to international law, over the South China Sea, and they continue to do that. I do not see that Australia is taking sides in terms of sovereignty disputes. It just asserts its international rights, and so does the United Kingdom, and so does France, and so do many other countries in and outside the region.
Dr. Wu, on that point, I think the UK and France have also sent their navies recently to the South China Sea. Is this a worrying sign for China that the issue is becoming more internationalized?
Yeah, I heard the news during the Shangri-La, this year's Shangri-La dialogue. both UK Defence Minister and France Defence Minister announced that UK and France will send its warships to the South China Sea to conduct a phenomenon in South China Sea. What I'm worrying is, what is the intention of both France and the UK to conduct a phenomenon in South China Sea? Is that true? Both those two countries are aiming at China. I'm not quite sure. So, in case that the France and UK send their workshops in South China Sea, I think China will have its countermeasures to oppose such behavior. In this case, I think those two countries send it because their concern, I think, is only the freedom navigation or safety of freedom navigation in the South China Sea. So if they want to challenge, China's, maritime interest in the South China Sea, I think China should take countermeasures to oppose that.
For example, what is the countermeasure?
It depends what behavior those countries' navies to conduct in the South China Sea. If they would like to follow the United States to conduct the phenops, enter the nearby waters of the territory areas or territorial sea of the peninsulas, I think China will take a strong, both strong political diplomatic position and the maritime, response measures to oppose such, actions.
Can I just say that the French Defense Minister at Shangri-La actually stated that there had been French phenops in the South China Sea, where French warships had been asked by Chinese vessels to leave the area. And her response was that the French captain just turned off the transponder and continued sailing. And the similar response came from the British. So it's not the case that they haven't ever done it before. It's just that they announced that they would increase the frequencies of those operations.
Dr. Wu, do you see, besides diplomatic, stringent, stern opposition, if France and the UK continue this, you said maritime measures. I suppose I'm curious to understand, would, in your view, your personal view, China be willing to use force to evict another power, whether it's the United States, but it could also be a European power, it actually could be another power too, one within the region, who goes within the territorial waters of the artificial islands?
Well, from my own point of view, if the warships sent by UK and France, even in the future Australia, to enter into the nearby waters of the Spratly Islands, currently controlled by China. China will take such measures as follow-up and monitoring. If China views such behavior or actions conducted by, France warships or UK warships as provocative to Chinese sovereignty or maritime interests, I think China should take the final way to chase them out of the nearby waters.
Sorry, Ben, as you said before, this is a long time game. France and the UK, who knows how much longer they'll have an appetite for this for? Trump himself has taken little interest in the South China Sea, even if the Pentagon, of course, has taken a long interest in it. I'm not sure Linda quite meant it in this fashion, but on hand-wringing or forcing China out of its position, hasn't that moment passed? I mean, China is a geopolitical fact in the region. For the US, it's a choice to be there. China can make it more costly. So if you look forward, is it very difficult, in fact, to stop the trend that we see in front of us?
I'm actually not so pessimistic. maybe that's my European background. Because
it would be very pessimistic.
Now, well, it is a long-term game. So what is it that you want to achieve in the end? Of course, the end game is not to evict China from the artificial island it has built. That ship, as you have said, has long sailed. But that doesn't mean that powers within the region and outside the region can impose costs on China quite substantially. So if it in the end one of the key objectives of China, and I would be very interested to hear whether that's true, is to establish, you know, dominance in the South China Sea, then of course the United States and the United Kingdom, which by the way has announced that it will deploy its first new aircraft carrier to the region, at least on a routine, on a rotating basis, they can deploy military assets into the region. Significant assets. Now, historical anachronism aside, during the Cold War, and I'm not saying that we are in a Cold War yet, but the United States and its European allies deployed significant military assets over a very long time, over what was then a formidable strategic opponent, if you will. Now, I'm not saying that China is an opponent. All I'm saying is that the United States and its allies, including Australia, will have possibilities to impose costs on China, just as China has opportunities to impose costs on Australia. But it's not like we have to pack up and go because China has built artificial islands and we haven't done anything about it. I'm really curious to know, Linda, as to how you persuade China to conduct global public goods from 3,000-meter airstrips, which are highly complicated and secretive military installations. How you persuade China to say, okay, let's do fishery sanctuary and the like. If I would be a PLA planner, I would go ballistic. Literally, if someone says, oh, please come in and join in regional public goods in my secret military airbase, I would.
You don't need to persuade China to do so. China has the intention, China wants to do that, to convince the international, the entire international community. China has no intention, you know, to, you know, conduct the so-called militarization in the South China Sea. China should provide public goods to the international community.
Aren't we past that? I mean, the South China Sea is militarized now, isn't this?
I don't think so. China, you know, the construction on those islands, I think you agree with, if we look at the history, soon after the World War II, Japan surrounded and the South China Sea, during World War II, the South China Sea islands controlled by Japan. Soon after, you know, Japan surrounded after World War II, it was China, you know, take over the South China Sea islands from Japanese hand. So construction on those islands and reefs is under China's sovereignty. I think you agree with me.
Well, a long, complicated discussion, actually. Yeah. And I'm going to come back to that. Linda, you had something to say in answer to
Ben? I suppose I'd just like to comment to Ben that no one's talking about others needing to pack up, like you said, and go away. I think we should recognize facts. China will be the dominant power in the South China Sea. Yes, you're quite right. The United States, United Kingdom, and many other countries could impose severe costs on China. But are they willing to? Do they want to? Is it rational to do so? China is not rising. China has risen. And I think the region has to find ways to come to terms with China and use the sway that we have with them to talk about not only the code of conduct, which I feel should be binding, but much more further, deeper issues of how to behave, how will the sea lines of communication be protected by China, what is unacceptable, where is the red lines. It's not a question of packing up and going. We all need those waters. But we should look facts in the face, and China has risen, and China will be the dominant power. That's my view.
Ben, have a quick response, then I'll have one more question for Dr. Wu.
I agree with you that China has risen. I don't know where this rising to. You are much more of an expert than I am. I see a lot of vulnerabilities within China itself, but that is an entirely different story. I think whether we have the will to do that, we will see. I have not counted the Americans out, because Trump may be Trump, but if you look at Indo-Pacific Command, you have an institution which has been building over 40, 50 years, which with enormous resources behind it, which is working 24/7 to increase actually its footprint in the region. So I, in purely military terms, I would not count the Americans out a second, nor would I discount the possibility that China, and maybe that's a bit too realist, will pay a price in the sense that you will have other countries that are responding to what they're seeing. Whether it's rational, I think that it really depends on where you sit. I really think it depends on what price you are willing to pay and what interest at the end of the day you see at stake. I do believe the stakes are very high, because as I said, I don't think the South China Sea can be, you know, just seen as a single entity removed from the much larger struggle that is at play.
So I want to briefly.
The new US Pacific Command, Phil Davison, said China is now capable of controlling the South China Sea in all scenarios short of war with the United States. Yeah. So you're right, they're preparing, but there is a degree of realism in a public statement like that.
May I respond to the dominance of South China Sea? China has no intention to dominate South China Sea, but China, you know, not allow other countries, you know, to dominate South China Sea. How to understand that? You know, from Chinese perspective, the South China Sea carries, you know, significance to China in terms of, you know, natural defense to China, national security, and also South China Sea provides strategic access to the ocean. And Australia, you are a big island surrounded by the sea. You don't worry about the strategic access to the sea, but China has a problem. If we look at the East China Sea and the Yellow Sea, blockaded by Japan and the United States as, you know, first island chain and the second island chain. So in this sense, South China Sea, maybe in the future, is the only strategic access for China to enter the ocean. So there is little room for China to compromise, allow the South China Sea dominated by other powers.
So just briefly before we go to questions, how much does China have to... We talked about strategic distrust with the US. What about with countries like Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia? Obviously, Duterte is a particular view, but he might be gone eventually. How much do you need to build up trust with your neighboring Asian countries?
It's easy for China to do so. For example, the COC consultation.
That's code of conduct.
That attract all Asian nations, particularly claimant states, the Philippines, you know, Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, or you know, for other claimant states to the South China Sea issue. Now we have, you know, reached a consensus on the single draft negotiating text. So in the future, if the COC is in place, we, China and ASEAN, you know, 10 members countries and our international community, don't worry about the peace and stability. The peace and stability will be guaranteed by the law-based order. So, and also China promotes maritime cooperation with other claimant states. For instance, China and now is discussing with the Philippines to conduct a joint development in the Red Bank area, and also China with the Philippines to discuss the law enforcement activities, you know, in the South China Sea region, even in the disputed area. Linda just mentioned the Scarborough Shoal area. So it is impossible, if we look at during the whole period since 2013 to 2016, the South China Sea arbitration case initiated by the Philippines, the bilateral relations was deteriorated. But now it's possible for our two nations to do so. So bilateral, you know, maritime cooperation between China and other claimant states is impossible. So COC, negotiation and discussion, and will attract the you know, attention or other 10 member states and also another bilateral relations, you know, focusing on the maritime cooperation.
Thank you. So we want to go to questions now. Just put up your hand. We've got roving microphones, and please, short, sharp questions. The panelists are here for the commentary, so please just keep them brief. Down the front there, a gentleman.
Hi, Peter Green. China's grown greatly in economic and influence recently, which is very commendable, and it has an initiative in the One Belt, One Road trade area. So how does China's build-up in the South China Sea influence other countries in joining in the One Belt, One Road cooperative venture?
Yes, so does the South China Sea issues, do they affect One Belt, One Road?
Good question. It's a problem. It's my concern. To be honest, the South China Sea dispute, you know, creates some negative impact for the cooperation between China and the neighboring country in the South China Sea region. For instance, Vietnam now still is reluctant to participate in the One Belt, One Road initiative. But the Philippines, now the situation has, you know, been changed since the bilateral relations was improved, and both China and the Philippines reached consensus that economic cooperation under the framework of the Belt and Road Initiative shouldn't be affected by the South China Sea dispute. So we need time. So in the future, I think once the COC is in place and maritime, you know, cooperation between China and other claimant states, you know, are conducting smoothly, the situation will be, you know, improving and making progress on this issue. Thank you.
Back over there to John.
Look, through you, Richard, I'd just like to put a couple of propositions to the panel. What you've been saying about South China Sea is very interesting. Personally, I buy the view that the game is almost over. The ship has sailed. I think the next question, though, that we have to look at very carefully is what is going to happen in the East China Sea, where the strategic face-off is actually far more crucial than the strategic face-off in the South China Sea. The Americans left Southeast Asia 10 years after Vietnam, essentially. They left Subic and Clark. They don't have a presence there of any significance. They have a major presence in Japan. A major presence. And Japanese security has been pivotal to American security since the Second World War. So it seems to me that the issues there are far more acute than the issues in the South China Sea. I'd like your comment on that. The second point is, what's going to happen on Taiwan? You're hearing a lot of coming out by way of comment that Xi Jinping is interested in doing something about Taiwan one way or another in the next decade. How he's going to do it, who knows? But clearly, the reunification in a serious sense between China and Taiwan is on the Chinese agenda. Now, how is that going to happen? Because it seems to me both those sets of developments flow on from the discussion of the South China Sea and are actually more crucial to Asian security than the South China Sea.
Okay, thanks, John. We've got two questions there. One is Japan-China, whether that's more potentially volatile than the South China Sea. Linda, you want to have a go on that one?
As always, excellent points and excellent questions. I wholeheartedly agree. East China Sea is strategically much more pivotal, obviously for obvious reasons, like you mentioned. U.S. interests are so much deeper, broader. I think the only point where I might, John, disagree with you on that is I understand the logic that what happens in the South China Sea will have a bearing on the East China Sea. I think they're very different situations because of the multiple claimants in the South China Sea, because China has been able to very deftly and with an agile touch do exactly what it wanted to do, but the United States has made it very clear that China cannot do what it wants to do with the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. And so it's a completely different ball game. We forget Taiwan at our peril. I know that Richard doesn't want us even to get into the whole Taiwan problematique. We're talking about the South China Sea, but I think Taiwan is absolutely crucial to the stability of the region in a way that neither the South China Sea or the East China Sea will be. I am one of those who are putting out in Canberra that within the next 10 years there will be movement. It's Xi Jinping's legacy issue. And we need to really start thinking deeply about a response to what could happen in the Taiwan Straits.
You're from the Institute of South China Sea Studies.
Okay, I should have moved to the East China Sea now.
No, but no. You can give us Xi Jinping's timetable for Taiwan if you like.
No. East China Sea. I'm not an expert on Taiwan issue. It's a complicated and sensitive issue.
Up the back there, Aaron.
Thanks, Richard. Aaron Conley from the Lowy Institute. Dr. Wu, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you've sketched out a sort of implicit bargain for countries in Southeast Asia. If they don't press, for instance, arbitral tribunal awards, then they can expect investment from China as part of the Belt and Road. They can be assured that there won't be radars constructed on reefs that they claim. Can you understand why these kinds of implicit threats are seem anachronistic in this region and cause apprehension in countries like Australia?
Talking about what he said, this sort of looks like a trade-off from you. In other words, if these countries get on with China, they might get investment. They won't have radars constructed on disputed territory. In other words, he was saying it was an implied threat against these countries to get on with China or you will suffer.
And do you understand that that looks like quite threatening,
out of date,
from Australia's point of view?
If you get on with China, you will get benefits. If you don't get on with China, you will be in trouble. And how does that look?
Okay, it's easy for me to address in Chinese, but it's difficult to address in. I don't think you Australian, you know, worry too much. I don't think you don't need to worry. I guess you might mention the economic cooperation in the South, you know, Pacific Islands nations, Chinese economic cooperation. From Australian perspective, might such cooperation, you know, pose threat to Australia national security? I don't think so. You know, economic cooperation between China, both in Southeast Asian nations and South Pacific Island nations, truly economic cooperation. I don't think China, as a developing country, has too much money to spend on those countries. It is a win-win, you know, win-win situation, economic cooperation. I don't think China is already posing threat to China and will be a threat to Australian national security.
Oh, thank you. My question is that in the South China Sea issue, China probably has the most extensive claims in this issue. But however, if we look at facts, I mean actual control and presence, China, I don't think China has the most extensive presence or actual control over the region, over the area, South China, over the South China Sea area. My question is that why China gets the most criticisms in this issue, while the other major claimants like Vietnam and the Philippines, they get compassion or even sympathy. Because if we talk about history, I think Vietnam her claims are also drawn large from history, and Vietnam, and I think have very extensive presence.
So why
on
does
the
only, why does China get most of the criticism? And other, who wants to answer that?
I'm happy to answer. Yeah. It's a very good question, because Vietnam has the most features under its quote unquote control in the South China Sea, a lot more than China. And Chinese friends always ask me, why is everyone picking on China? We're only one player of many. Well, number one, China has to get used to being a big power, and people pick on big powers, and China just has to get used to being in the spotlight under criticism. This pertains to a lot of things that happen in China. They have to have a bit of a thicker skin. But specifically, China has coerced or used force and started to build artificial islands, which the others have not done at this scale. So when you're big, you're powerful, and you start moving at the speed and with the force that China has, yeah, it frightens people. It's like this, you know, huge elephant in the room, which is frightening, and people are reacting to it.
My two cents. That's all true, but I think there's two other factors. One is, unlike Vietnam or whoever else claims, China is seen as a revisionist power by many states in the region. That is not true for Vietnam. Secondly, if you look at what China has been building on these islands when we're talking about military installations, it dwarfs everything that Vietnam and others have ever built and will ever build. So China has been putting capabilities on those islands which are really problematic in military terms. It has done things like deploying a potentially even nuclear-capable aircraft on those islands, very sophisticated surface-to-air missiles, very sophisticated radars, and on and on and on. Vietnam and Taiwan and whoever else there is, the Philippines, do not come even close. And that is the problem. Not who has more islands. So we're talking about 3,000-meter airstrips compared to 140 meters or 150 meters in the case of the Philippines and Vietnam. That is massive in terms of operational differences. And so that is why, apart from all these other factors that Linda has mentioned, people are worried.
So we're going to have two more, you want to have questions still? Two more quick questions, we'll take them both at once.
Thank you for the excellent discussion. Linda said that China has risen, but over the medium-term future, many economists think that China could run into economic problems for various reasons, economic crises, and of course that could result in social instability. How do you think these domestic factors may impinge on China's policy towards the South China Sea in the future?
Professor Wu said that China wants sovereignty but not dominance. What degree of control do you think China wants, will ultimately settle for in the South China Sea? And one quick question for Professor Wu. You say Australia's not neutral on the South China Sea. Can you name a couple of countries that are neutral from China's perspective?
And just, there's a question just to your right, the woman to your right. A very quick question.
Yeah,
last
thanks
one.
Very much. I just, this question is for Professor Linda. I just want to know, because the China-Australian relations was greatly affected by Australia's high-profile position on the South China Sea, but on the other hand, it's obvious that Australia wants to keep its economic cooperation with China. So from your perspective of view, what's your suggestion for Canberra to maintain such very tricky balance?
Okay, so I've got Chinese domestic instability, degree of control, and Australia's economic interests, and also neutral countries. Why don't you go first?
So many. If we look at the arbitration case, 2016, July 2016, when the arbitral tribunal issued its final ruling, you know, there are, more, I'm not quite sure, more than 80 countries and 100 international organizations, you know, support the Chinese stance. No non-acceptance, non-participation, and non-recognition of Chinese stance. So those countries should be viewed as the neutral stance towards the South China Sea issue. So many. But Australia used to be neutral stance, but no longer now. Neutral India, Russia, now Singapore as a nation of ASEAN.
Okay, Singapore. Singapore, just
Singapore
says
now. Now, I mean now. I thought Singapore just had a slightly lower voice because their chair of ASEAN. It's important law to promote the COC consultation.
Okay, Singapore, yes, that's right. Linda?
Obviously, domestic stability would have an effect on the whole region on a whole host of issues, not just South China Sea. And you're quite right to always remind us that China has risen. China can still stumble. But I think the Chinese economy is such that even with a not a crash, but a stumble, it will remain a very big economy, and China will remain a powerful country. And I personally think that it is the haste that we're seeing with which China is moving. For example, the haste with which they built these islands and so on. They very much see their window of opportunity now because of demographic reasons, because of inattention from the United States. I mean, there's a whole host of reasons. They themselves recognize that there might be problems down the line. Someone asked me, oh yes, Australia. Well, I said in my opening remarks, I think Australia could play quite a constructive role and take the lead in seeing the artificial islands being used for more public goods, for more constructive purposes. Here, I am not as pessimistic as Ben. I think they could be used. I think China has to be constantly nudged and encouraged to think of the region's best and not just its own best. But you're quite right. Australia has to find a way to come to terms with China simply because of the economic dependency of Australia on China.
Finally, our European optimist or pessimist, I'm not quite sure what.
I'm a European, by the way, too, just yes. so that yeah. no one forgets.
Yes, that's right. How much control? I think quite a lot. For one, if you think in terms of mental maps, I think if I follow the Chinese discussion, then there's no doubt that the South China Sea is called South China Sea for a reason. And the foreign minister of China said it well in an ASEAN meeting in 2015, I think it was. We are a big country and you are a small country. And that's what he said to the ASEAN countries. But
He was looking at the Singapore foreign ministry.
But China also needs to exert quite significant control over the South China Sea for the very fact that Dr. Wu mentioned, namely for strategic military reasons. If it is true that it is one of the only areas from which the PLA can sort of break out and project power into the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific, then you need to exert quite significant military control. As China is trying to also learn how to operate fairly sophisticated nuclear-powered submarines, you need to control large parts of the South China Sea in order to make it more difficult for the Americans and others to track where you're going. And finally, if we're then talking about Taiwan, and here comes the South China Sea comes back into the picture, if you think about a Taiwan scenario, and you, the United States, let's say for the sake of the argument, decides to intervene on behalf of Taiwan, if you can complicate American movements through the South China Sea in the defense of Taiwan, from a Chinese perspective, that is quite an important strategic asset. So I think all of these factors together tell me that from a Chinese perspective, you want to exert quite a significant amount of strategic control of the South China Sea, but I might be wrong.
Okay, on that note, please thank all of our panelists, and thank you for coming.